You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Lisbeth Steer. I am a fellow at the Center for Universal Education at Brookings. And it's a real pleasure to have you all here today. We're here to present the Arab World Learning Barometer. I will provide a brief overview of the barometer, and then we will hand it over to Kim Gattas and our great panel here to discuss what the implications are of the findings for the region. First, I'd like to say a couple of words about why we actually went into this and why we did the barometer. Over the past decades, we've made a lot of progress in getting children into school, partly sort of spurred on by the Millennium Development Goals. So we were doing a really great job. But in recent years, we've all come to the realization that we need to expand our attention in three ways. One is we really need to start focusing more on those children that are being left behind, the disadvantaged groups. We also really need to pay a lot more attention to the quality of education and what kids are actually learning when they're in school. And thirdly, we need to look at secondary and post-secondary education to complement what's been going on in primary, and especially relevant to today, what kind of skills are children getting while in school that prepare them for the labor market. So the Arab Learning Barometer is really trying to look at those issues. It looks at access to primary and secondary school. It looks at are children completing primary and secondary school? What are they learning in primary and secondary school? And then also, what is the transition into the labor market? It draws on data from a variety of sources, including the UNESCO Institute for Statistics, international assessments, such as you may have heard of PIRLS and PISA and TIMSS, and then also, obviously, employment data. Before I go into the results, I want to highlight two facts. One is the data itself, which is really a concern. When we were setting out to do the barometer, we were really excited because we were going to get a complete picture of what is going on. We were disappointed. The data is really scarce. Of the 20 countries we looked at, 13 have some kind of international assessment at either primary or secondary level. Only 7 have assessments at both levels. So it's really quite limited in terms of the data out there. Secondly, what we also need to remember when we look at the region is that we're talking about quite a wide variety of countries in terms of their socioeconomic background. We have, on the one hand, Yemen that has like a per capita income of about $1,000 to Qatar, where you have $80,000 per capita. So we're talking about a real sort of mixed bunch of countries as well. So what did we find? First of all, the good news, children are getting into school. They are getting access into school. In most countries, net enrollment rates are above 90%. The total number of children that are out of school has declined over the past decade from about 12 million in the beginning of the decade for primary and secondary to now under 9 million, which is really an achievement given the population growth in the region. The other piece of good news is that over 90% are completing their primary education, which is also something that we are obviously really looking at, not only getting kids into school, but also making sure that they stay there and learn. We do recognize, however, that some countries are doing much better than others, and some groups, populations, are doing much better than others. So, for example, disparities exist between countries. Secondary enrollment ranges from about 40% in Yemen to 95% in Oman. But even more severe are the disparities within countries. Progress has been made in addressing gender disparities. Certainly, the region has made a lot of progress in getting girls into school, and a gender parity index has improved, but the region is still the worst in terms of gender disparity compared to other regions in the world. Now, even more worrying is that when you look at also income and location disparities, and you combine those with gender disparities, the picture becomes even more grim. 45% of poor rural women in Egypt have less than 2 years of education, compared to only 1% of rich urban men. So this is something that, of course, we need to keep an eye on, even when we look at the good news. Now, when we look at learning, the news, unfortunately, is pretty bad across the board. More than half of primary-age children are not reaching basic learning benchmarks, and just under half of secondary-age children. Now, what does this mean? At primary age, this actually means that children after 4 years of schooling are not able to read a sentence, nor are they able to add up or subtract whole numbers, something that you would expect they would be able to do. Again, learning varies significantly across countries within the region. It's much better in some countries. For example, Bahrain scores has about 30% of children not learning, but it gets pretty bad if you look at Yemen, where 90% of children are not reaching basic learning benchmarks. What's particularly striking is also that if you look at countries with similar income levels, you find that, again, across the board, the region is scoring much worse than others. So if we look at, for example, Singapore and Qatar, those are countries with similar income levels, we find in Singapore 99% of children are reaching those benchmarks, compared to only half in Qatar. The same for other countries of middle income status, as shown on the graph here. We also have a lot of spending on education in the region. Again, wondering how does that not translate into better learning outcomes. Now, sadly, this learning crisis also impacts opportunities for young people once they leave the school system. There's a strong connection between learning and employment opportunities. 40% of employers in the Arab world cite skill shortage as a serious constraint. The Arab World Competitiveness Report ranks education as one of the most significant constraints to economic growth. Youth are dropping out of the labor market, or even if they enter it, they're not able to find jobs. Youth unemployment is between 20 and 30% in most of the countries. You can see Jordan there, the statistics for both youth labor participation and unemployment, a pretty bad picture. Finally, we found an interesting picture when we look at girls. As I said earlier, the situation for girls has improved massively. There are more girls getting into school, and access has improved. So this is actually an example here for Tunisia. We see in Tunisia, actually, the girls and boys are getting into school at a more or less equal rate. That's not the case for all regions, all countries, by the way. In Yemen, for example, has a lot of disparities still. Once they're in school, interestingly, girls seem to be doing slightly better. They are transitioning from primary to secondary at a higher rate than boys. They are also consistently also learning more. So that is another interesting fact that's happening in the school system. Now, when they leave, unfortunately, here is where the picture changes again. Girls are doing, or women are doing, much worse than men. In Tunisia, labor force participation rate is only 20% for girls. It's more than 40% for boys. The unemployment rate, youth unemployment rate, is 35% for girls and only 27% for boys. So this is something that we certainly are also found quite striking when we looked at the data. So where do we go from here? The report really tried to set out some information and data. We didn't actually go into depth into sort of what needs to be done, but we did highlight some areas that could be explored to address this learning crisis. The first one is early childhood education. We all know the evidence is very clear. Investing in early childhood education has great and massive effects on learning outcomes later on in life. It makes sense to invest. At the moment, enrollment in early childhood education in the Arab world is about 20%. It's too low. We need to think about ways we can improve that. Secondly, engaging the private sector. I think we will discuss this a little later on. How can we get the private sector involved? They clearly have there will be a real benefit if they get engaged. There's a skill shortage. It makes sense for them to be engaged. How do we do it? How do we engage them in the dialogue? How do we engage them even in the provision in a more effective way? Thirdly, the data. I mentioned it earlier. We just need to do something. Countries need to do something. It's the learning data. It's even basic education data, enrollment data, survival rate data. It's just we don't have enough information. Also data on financing. What are we actually spending on education? Fourthly, the teachers. This year's Education Global Monitoring Report was focused on teachers. The Arab world represents the second biggest share of the global teacher gap after sub-Saharan Africa. So we need to do something about improving the quality and also increasing the numbers of teachers. Finally, we all know the challenges of conflict in the area. Today, because of the Syrian conflict, more than 1 million children have fled to neighboring countries. They are no longer getting an education. We need to make sure that we don't forget about them because it could have huge impacts on their lives. So how can we as an international community find better models to really help them as well? So this gives us a bit of food for thought. For those of you who would like to explore the data, because there's a lot behind the headline numbers I've given you, we've created an interactive on the website. It's a sort of tool where you can go in and compare countries and look at data behind the headline data, disparities, and so on. It's really fun. I encourage you to look at it. So I would like to now introduce Kim Gattas and the panel. I will introduce Kim. You have her bio in your sheets there. Kim is the BBC State Department radio and TV correspondent and has traveled extensively with the Secretary of State, also including to the region. Before this role, she was the Middle East correspondent for the BBC and the Financial Times based in Beirut. Kim knows a lot about the region. You are also from Lebanon, I understand. So we're really so glad to have you with us, Kim. And thank you so much to the panelists as well for the discussion. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us, and thank you to Elizabeth for this presentation. I'm really delighted to be here. As Elizabeth mentioned, I am from the region. I am Lebanese. I was fortunate to have a great education because I went to a private school and private university, but it is important to keep in mind that that opportunity is not afforded to everybody in the region, and that's why we are here to talk about the gaps. Some of those gaps have led to the unrest that we've seen unfold in the region over the last 3 years, the gap between education, the desire for a better life, for better jobs, and a job market that just isn't ready to meet the demand, and to give people a sense of direction and hope for the future. As Elizabeth mentioned, there is a fantastic online data web with all the details that she mentioned and much more. It's beautifully done. I really encourage you to explore it. And for those who are following us on Twitter as well, the hashtag is Arab Learning. It's very important to raise, I think, awareness about this this issue. Because it's easy to, get distracted by the daily news coming out of the region about the upheavals, but it's important to remember that we need to think about the long term. And if we want to improve things long term, we need to focus on education. We're very lucky to have a great panel to discuss this report with us this morning. I'll start with Perihan Abu-Zayd on my left. I'll keep the bios brief. You have them in your pamphlets. But just to introduce our panelists briefly, Perihan is currently doing an MIT at the Sloan School of Management. She studied in Egypt. She has a first-hand impression as well of the education system, and we'll get her views on that. She won an award for Best Female Entrepreneur from the MIT Enterprise. She's the CEO and co-founder of Qabila Media Productions, which provides online content in a very innovative way for Egypt and the region, and we'll be very curious to see what entrepreneurship perhaps can do in the region as well. Shanta Devarajan is the chief economist of the World Bank of the World Bank's Middle East and North Africa region. He joined the World Bank in 1991. He was director of the World Development Report in 2004, making services work for poor people. I was reading one of your conference papers from, I think, a few years ago about the Palestinian paradox, investing in education, which continues in the Palestinian territories despite high unemployment. People still have ambition to educate their children. Only 1% of Palestinians are illiterate, is what was said in your report. That is a very interesting point that you raise in that report. Magdi Amin is, as of Monday, interim head of the International Finance Corporation. Before that, he was based in Cairo, managing the IFC's investment climate team. So he comes to us from that direction. He also has a lot to say about the private sector, and we'll be talking to him about how the private sector can help bridge the gap between education and unemployment. He's also the author of After the Spring, Economic Transitions in the Arab World. And at the far end, Hafiz Ghanem is a senior fellow here at Brookings Institute, working on global economy and development in the Global Economy and Development Program, and he is one of the authors of today's report. Hafiz, I'm going to start with a question to you in a second, and I want to know a little bit more about the why. You know, we've heard a lot about the data that is in the report, but I'm curious to hear a little bit more about the why. Before Brookings, Hafiz worked at the Food and Agricultural Organization. He was the Assistant Director General responsible for Economic and Social Development Department. And before that, he spent many, many years at the World Bank. Thank you all very much for joining us. Remember, the hashtag is Arab Learning. We're all about raising awareness well beyond the policy establishment of Washington, try to raise awareness in the region as well, where there is, you know, a lot of money going into education. We're not seeing the impact of that. Hafiz, I want to start with you, and I want to see whether perhaps you can enlighten us about some of those issues. You know, why is it that kids are not learning? They're in school, but they're not learning.
It's a great question. Why are they not learning? And it's a question that we are asking ourselves, because, as Lisbeth explained, also it does not seem to be a problem of resources. It is not that they don't have money. I mean, if nearly half of the children in Qatar are not learning, it cannot be because Qatar is a poor country. It's has the highest, one of the highest GDP per capita in the world. There are probably several possible explanations. I do not know which one is the right one. One explanation is on the, let me start with, on the demand side for education. In some of the countries, the maybe education is not seen as particularly important or necessary. If, as a young Qatari, you are sure that whether you learn or you don't learn, you're going to get a good job in government. And my understanding is that your starting salary is more than $100,000 a year. So why learn? So there might be this kind of question there. On the other hand, this cannot be true for other countries in the region. In Tunisia, for example, or in Morocco, we saw the very disturbing numbers about low learning levels in Morocco. People value learning, and they don't have the kind of resources that some people in the Gulf countries have. They need to be competitive. They need to find a job, and therefore they put a lot of weight on learning and going to school. And there, my hunch is that the problems is more on the delivery mechanism for education. And there, I see problems at two levels, at least. The first level is the in terms of the curriculum. Is the curriculum that are being proposed for the children really the ones that they need? Are they adapted to the social realities, to the demands of the labor market? And in that respect, one of the observations I received from talking to private sector people back in the region is that students in the region do not learn what we call 21st century skills, like working in teams, problem solving, being innovative, risk-taking. So there is a problem with the curriculum that's too traditional, that is too much based on rote learning. Learning things by heart, mm-hmm. rather than...
I remember that very well when I was a kid in school. Even in a private school in Lebanon, we had that problem.
So that is the first part of the problem. And if the children, if the boys and girls going to school do not, and if their parents do not see that curriculum as being particularly pertinent for them, they lose interest. The second part of it, even if whatever the curriculum is, it is not delivered in an effective way. We see a lot of problems in terms of the quality of teachers, in terms of the numbers of teachers. Mm-hmm. Even when we have good teachers and the right numbers, we see a huge problem in Yemen, for example. We were looking at the numbers for teacher absenteeism. There are teachers and they're good, but they don't go to school. So it's as if they're not there. There is no, the parents are not involved, communities are not involved in the teaching process. So this is my hunch about why mm-hmm. we are getting those rather discouraging results. And it would be different from country to country. I think in the Gulf countries, there might be an issue with the on the demand side, that people might not feel that education is particularly important, but in the rest of the Arab world, I think it is more of a problem on the delivery side, on the quality of the curriculum and on how this curriculum is being taught.
I want to move to Perhan in just a second, but just very quickly, Hafiz, what was the most striking finding for you in that report? You worked on it. What was the one finding that struck you the most as surprising?
Actually, the very low learning rates in some countries where, like for example, Morocco. I was very surprised because those of us who go off into the region, we tend to interact with the, I would say, with the elites of the region. Yes. And the impression I had, for example, of Morocco is that you have a very well-educated elite. And very close to Europe. And therefore, to see them that more than half of the children, or nearly 65% of the children, are not learning, for me, that was quite shocking.
Yeah. It's also, for me, what was very striking was to see that in Qatar, for example, nearly 50% of kids in school are not learning. I mean, I found that quite striking as well. Perihan, I want to move to you and ask you, you know, what was your impression looking back, or what is your impression today as an adult, looking back at your education, and whether you agree with Hafiz about what might be some of the issues when it comes to the educational offerings in the region. And then I'll ask you also briefly about how entrepreneurship can potentially help people in the region.
So do I agree 100%? 100% firsthand experience with everything that's been said. And one thing that I would actually like to emphasize is the issue of curriculum. Mm-hmm. And it goes beyond the textbook. It's not just what we're learning, you know, about physics or about math, but it's actually the actual skills that we should acquire in the classroom and then apply them in, you know, in our lives and in our future careers. So one thing that I learned, for instance, so Qabila is like technically my fourth entrepreneurial experience. I started three companies, but I started my entrepreneurial career when I was in grade 8.
Selling drawings, right?
No, I was selling like, you know, personalized bracelets, and I made over $1,000 for a kid in Egypt to make $1,000. That is huge, and not a single person. Yeah, right. And my mom was scared. She thought, you know, that other parents are going to be mad, and maybe, you know, I'll get detention. And no teacher recognized that talent. So, and I was never encouraged to practice that until my last startup that is now valued at, you know, a couple of million dollars, my parents were still telling me, don't quit Google to join this, you know, your startup. So because they couldn't see that, and there is nothing in the education system that will encourage that. There is nothing in the education system that will encourage analytical thinking. It's, in fact, frowned upon, you know, to do mm-hmm. so, to question your teacher, question your parent. Oh, you're rude. While that's something that encourages creativity. There is no practice of teamwork, not even in sports. So I grew up as well playing basketball competitively, and that taught me teamwork, taught me leadership skills, but also taught me to accept failure. And because, you know, if I lose a game, it doesn't necessarily mean that I'm a failure. You know, I will fail in everything. It means that, you know, I just have a better shot at it next time or a different shot at it. That is something that we don't encourage. We don't have, there is nothing from, you know, unless you're in private school in a very, like, maybe probably even an international school, there is no practice of teamwork whatsoever. And obviously there is no practice of leadership because there are no student clubs. There are no, like, leadership opportunities within the, obviously, the public sector, but also in the private sector, private education, which I joined. So all those things altogether, they add to the deficiency in the textbook education or curriculum. And I think those are the skills that are very much needed to create a strong society that can, you know, survive different challenges like what we're facing right now. I think one of the biggest problems, you know, with the situation that we're in Egypt right now specifically, and the rest of the regions where revolutions or, you know, conflicts are happening, is the fact that we don't communicate. We never learn to communicate. Again, something like debate society doesn't exist. So now when you disagree with someone, he's automatically your enemy. And that is a huge problem in real life. And that's, I think, that's one of the biggest problems that we're facing now. And it all starts, you know, from school experience, basically.
Magdi, I want to move to you and get your input, because As you pointed out just before we started, and as Lisbeth pointed out as well in the report, it's not for lack of investment in the educational sector. I mean, there is a lot of money going into it, almost as much per capita as South Asia, you said. So why are we seeing this lack of learning? And moving on from there, how do we fix this and tailor the educational sector to feed the needs of a job market? Because in the end, there's no point being educated either if you can't find a job. So how do the two meet together?
First of all, thank you to Brookings. Brookings has made tremendous contributions in this whole question. And I remember back to the Generation in Waiting report and the stuff that the Wolfensohn Center was doing also on social entrepreneurship. So this is a good continuation of that story for Brookings. And I think education is a great...
Can continue.
Praising
continues. Let's keep on.
We'll give
let's
you 10 on. Minutes to praise Brookings.
Just to correct, I'm not the interim head of IFC, just the change team. There's a reform process going on in IFC, and they've asked me to lead it on an interim basis.
I just promoted you.
But, I see social media out there. We don't, you know, there's some messages that we want to make sure we correct right away. So. but it's an honor to be here. It's, you know, as Elizabeth was speaking about the Syria crisis also, I mean, the brutal irony of the region is that the two countries where the civil wars have been really, really severe and deep, many of them, but Iraq and Syria are the historical centers of learning for not only for the region but for the world, with the Abbasids and the Umayyads and Bayt al-Hikmah and the stories that we all understand. The biggest libraries in the world were there. And yet today we're looking at such a deep crisis where education is one but a very important part of it. You know, I think historically the region has suffered wave after wave of regimes that are good at centralization. And the Ottomans and the post-Ottomans, the colonial, the current regimes. And that system of trying to control the way even delivery, even increasing the quantity of education, in doing so in a way that isn't necessarily responsive to the needs of societies that evolve, and that isn't scalable to the population demographics. And that's the same. The same is true for the private sector, where over the last two decades we saw a private sector that was able to emerge, but in a way that it was sort of limited and very linked to the opportunities that the state could afford. And now we've certainly outgrown that. And in order to move forward, the private sector needs to be in a position to play a role in defining not necessarily the quantity, but the quality of what gets taught. Mm-hmm. My last job in MENA, I just came back in August from running the investment climate team. We did something called the Education for Employment Initiative for Arab Youth, where essentially we worked with a sector, the IT sector in Jordan, or the hotel tourism sector in Morocco, a few other sectors and regions, and worked with them to define really on a deep level what are the qualifications and standards that are needed, and then work back into the education system to see on an all hands on deck basis, whether through private investment, or through bringing in other providers from outside, building capacity of the existing institutions, what can be done to match the need. And there's systematic barriers. In Egypt, you need the president. And at the time we started this, I don't think it was still – yeah, it was still Mubarak when we were doing the studies, but it's been several since – to sign the authorization to start a private university. Now, he's not going to sign authorization for a private – he's got bigger fish to fry than to authorize a private university. But that speaks to sort of the level of control, not only the entry process, but in the curriculum and the standards and what gets taught, many of which were obsolete – and many of which were sort of linked to the informality, whereas, as Hafiz was saying, teachers are not showing up because they're getting paid on the side to do private tutoring. And those standards to enter the profession are also for sale. You know, you can pay a little bit and get the standard. The system was credentialist and not outcome-based. There's a lack of transparency, where the institutions that are performing better aren't necessarily being rewarded. And so we need to move to a system that's more where the state is enforcing the right standards, but we're in a more competitive environment where different types of delivery can compete to meet the needs that are clearly defined by the end users and by students, and that they have the tools, like the barometer, for understanding who's performing and who's not performing, and resources and enrollments can flow to the better performing systems.
Shanta, I'm going to move to you because just before we started, you raised a point that Magdi just made, and that is the involvement of politics as one of the impediments towards, you know, better education for everybody. You know, there's a lot of money being spent in private schools. There's a lot of prestige attached to having, you know, American universities establish campuses in Gulf countries. But how do you make sure that education is good and available for everybody? And is there perhaps too much of an obsession with the prestige element of a higher education and not enough focus on making it accessible for everybody?
Thank you, and thanks for this very interesting panel. Let me just take one step back and go back to this point about demand that Hafez raised at the beginning. I think in the Arab world, there's no question that one group of people are demanding quality education, and that is the students and the parents of the students. And you see that. The tutoring that Magdi just mentioned is a sign. You know, parents are not satisfied with the quality the children are getting in the regular public school, so they pay. And these are not rich people. These are some poor people who invest huge sums of money in making sure their children learn English and they actually learn to add and subtract from when they're in primary school. So there's no question. There is a huge demand for quality. So then the question is, why is the supply not meeting that demand? What's going wrong there? And I think it is the problem is with accountability. That the system that has been designed has not been designed to be accountable to those parents and to those students. That's why we see teachers who are absent at 19% of the time in Yemen, and I think it's about the same in Morocco, because the teachers are paid whether or not they show up for work. And they're not fired easily because that's the point there, is that you've got a very powerful teachers' unions. You've got very powerful government administrators who are defending them and find them politically valuable. And they are able to block any attempt at reform, including contestability, what Magdi was talking about. If you try to introduce something like, let's give students vouchers and let them choose to go to public school or private school, there are protests in the streets. And it's interesting. They're protests by the public school teachers. So that's a sign to me that these people are earning some huge rents and don't want those rents to be dissipated by the possibility that these children will get a good education. And then let me just go back to the other question, which is, why is the curriculum so weak or so flawed, not delivering on what what is needed for the 21st century market? There again, you have to ask the question, surely we know what's needed for the 21st century market. Why is it not? Well, there's no connection. The public school system designs its own curriculum, and nobody's questioning whether that's the curriculum that is needed. Whereas you find, like with the experience with apprenticeship programs and the Education for Employment program that Magdi referred to, where if you have the private sector actually have a role in designing the curriculum, including the potential employers actually telling them what you want, then you start getting a curriculum that actually is suited to the needs. So it's a very difficult problem. If I could just add one, if I have one minute, to add one thing, and this is maybe even more controversial, because I think we all have to share in the blame for this. And it's something I've been thinking about lately, which is, it could be that the focus on enrollment, the MDGs that Elizabeth mentioned, actually has detracted from the focus on quality, that there's actually a trade-off. We've been thinking for a long time, well, first you've got to get the kids in school, and then you've got to make sure that they learn. And that's, you know, in a sort of engineering way, that makes sense. But the point is, actually, enrollment is very easy to do. You can get the kids into school. We know how to do that. Mm-hmm. Right, and if you say we have a goal of 100% enrollment, that means that guarantees jobs for the public school teachers, right? Because they'll be there to get the kids into school. A learning goal, learning quality or quality of education goal is much harder to meet because, frankly, we don't know exactly how to get it. But it also means that there's a potential for the private sector. The schools, which do, as Kim mentioned, which do provide a better education or more cost-effective education. So that's competition, which is why, you know, any time you mention, let's drop the enrollment goal and switch to a quality goal, you get huge resistance, again, because of the politics.
We're going to keep talking a little bit within the panel, and then we'll open the floor to questions in just a few minutes. I wanted to get, Magdi, your reaction to what Shanta is saying about the role of the private sector. If you can expand a little bit more on what you were saying and talk perhaps a little bit about the role of apprenticeship.
First of all, I think a broader point about social accountability and participation. First of all, I think we're at a point in the region where there is a need for agendas that are positive sum. Because of where we are being so contestable about politics and about the sort of zero-sum thinking about the way contests are conducted, in order to move forward, we need to have agendas where value is created by having multiple perspectives at the table, and that when those perspectives are at the table, the pie expands. I think education is a great platform for us to focus on in the region for that reason, because it's so clear that the status quo is creating negative or suboptimal outcomes for everyone. I mean, what struck me about the female participation question is that here you have the group of society that enrolls more and does better and yet participates least. The same would be true, and broadly speaking, for a lot of the education. We're getting the spending. We're not getting the outcomes. The private sector has a huge stake to play. And when they're organized, and not all sectors are organized, but when they are, they are not only able to define what they need, but they're also able to organize themselves to even finance and develop the institutions themselves. So the Jordanian example is one where we've seen them create a little institution that is sourcing training specifically to fill gaps that they have throughout sort of the post-hiring process.
But should they be involved in connecting with public schools or funding more private schools? How is that connection made?
Yeah. So I think they are agnostic as to where the supply comes from if it meets their needs. And I think that's sort of key. It's really about making sure that the outcomes, the outputs of the system are reflecting the needs, and that we are focusing attention on making sure that those institutions that do meet the needs are getting resources, are getting licensed. But a private sector contribution can be made that is not very helpful, and there's a need for, I think, a regulatory role and a transparency role, so that there are consequences even for the private sector.
Because there needs to be accountability there as well.
There needs to be accountability. And different over time, different types of institutions will position themselves differently to fill different needs in the market. They'll be very, like in the U.S., you have applied public and very research-oriented public institutions. And you have the same in the private sector. So it's really about quality, and it's really about outcomes, and it's really about being responsive to demand. And the private sector has shown itself to be very willing to participate in those processes. It's really making sure that the rigidities in the response can be addressed.
Right. You raise a point about girls at school. I'm intrigued by, and I want your input as well, but I'm intrigued by the fact that girls who I'm assuming are going to the same school as boys are learning more. What explains that? And I want to comment from the three men on the panel about how do we improve education for women, because it's great to have women talk about improving women's rights in the Arab world, but if the men are not on board, it's not going to happen. So we want the input from you as well.
No, the fact that girls do better than boys in school should not surprise anybody. I mean, it is sort of universal, and as the father of a girl and a boy, I can see that.
But they're getting the same level of low, let's say, standard
what
education.
What is really important, Kim, and what is striking and is a serious problem in the Arab world, is what happens after they finish school. It is, so we have girls. Let us look, Tunisia is a wonderful example, because there is parity. Actually, if you look at people finishing university, there are more girls graduating from university yes. in Tunisia than men. However, only 22% of those women enter the labor market. And if you look at the unemployment rate, nearly more than a third of those women, so 22%, only 22% enter the labor market. Of those 22%, one third is unemployed. So that means that roughly 15% of your educated women and are working. Now, this is a human rights issue. I mean, if you have all those educated women who are unable to work, it's a major problem. It's also an economic problem. It's a waste.
Absolutely.
Can you imagine all how much the Tunisian government is investing in the education to produce one university graduate, how much the family has invested, how much the girl herself has invested, and then she's sitting at home and not working much. The female labor force participation ratio in the Arab world is the lowest anywhere else. The young female unemployment rates are the highest. People look at the at youth unemployment in the Arab world and say youth unemployment is very high. If you break down the youth unemployment rate between males and females, the male unemployment rate is high, but it is comparable to what you see in other countries. It is the female unemployment rate that is extremely high. In Egypt, it is the female unemployment rate for young women, unemployment rate is double that for young men.
Berihan, perhaps you want to give us your input on this. You obviously were able to transcend some of those issues. You were very creative, entrepreneurial. What is it like for your friends in Egypt, and what do you think is the role of youth and civil society in helping women breakthrough into the labor force? What is it about working conditions in Egypt, in the Arab world, perhaps in the informal sector, that are making it that difficult, in your view, for women to participate?
So when it comes to the question of why young women, educated young women, get into the labor market or they start working, I believe there are different reasons, and so many of them, but I think there are two that are extremely strong. And I'm going to draw an analogy even with the U.S. here. One is obviously the working conditions. So the fact that women, we're obviously like a very masculine society, and women, we, you know, like many other countries around the world, we still believe that the woman has the role of, you know, of taking care of the family and being married and everything, and there is no public or private sector that actually appreciates basically that part. So it's always a problem. There are actually women, young women, that are denied jobs because they have an engagement ring and they're expected to be married soon enough. And I know a friend of mine that was denied a job because she has just gotten married, and literally the person that was hiring her told her that I'm expecting you to get married, and I don't want to lose my employee after 9 months, 9 to 10 months. So there are no working conditions that would actually sort of appreciate in a way the cultural obligations that the women have. And at the same time, there is no, like, working from home policies. Maternity benefits are not so great. And maybe, you know, there are some benefits in the private sector, but they're not so great. And that is what where I think entrepreneurship actually makes a difference, because entrepreneurship actually offers that flexibility. So when you compare with the entrepreneurial scene in the Middle East, like just last week I read this article about Saudi entrepreneur, young rising young entrepreneurs in Saudi Arabia, 50% of them are women. That is not by any means comparable to any of the other sectors. And I've seen this. I've seen in Algeria a startup that was founded by a huge startup that's now exporting to Europe that was started by five young women under the age of 25. I mean, like five female entrepreneurs in the U.S. is a huge thing. Imagine in Algeria. And I think entrepreneurship can make that difference. And at the same time, and that is sort of like a broader perspective, what really strengthens those kind of values, like that the fact that a woman should stay at home or a woman should take care of the family or, you know, take care of her looks better than, you know, more than getting educated and employed. I think media has a huge impact in that. So Hollywood, for instance, they're talking a lot about what they call the CSI effect, which is basically how CSI has made the role of forensics basically, or made it sexy for women to be part of it, because you see all those like women, and it actually made that difference. And now they're investigating, you know, and making huge efforts. Now there are companies that are actually consulting Hollywood producers, big studios, on how we can actually use that for technology, like to encourage more women to get into science and technology. And when you look at Arab media, there is no different picture. It's always one picture of women it portrays them as, you know, people that, or they should look nice, they should be at home. There is nothing that actually, in a subtle way, can actually change that kind of perspective about women, our perception. And I think that's another perspective.
If I can get very briefly from Shanta, Magdi, and Hafiz, a very quick point from each one of you about how we encourage, how it is possible to break through those barriers and help women come into the employment market more. Why don't you start, Shanta? Okay.
Just picking up on your earlier question, one of the reasons why the labor force participation rate is so low is that, in fact, most of the men go into the informal sector. The lion's share of new entrants in the labor market are not finding jobs in the formal private sector, and certainly not in the public sector anymore.
But a lot in the public sector still, or
no. The public sector employment rate has actually been growing very slowly, if at all. The wages have been increasing, right. And which is why they can't afford to hire anymore. But the informal sector is very hostile to women, shall we say. There is evidence that, you know, women face a lot of harassment, crime, and other things. So if that one safety valve that is now open is also closed off to women, they drop out of the labor force. So I think we need to turn that around and say, let's make the informal sector such as it is, because it's so big. In some of these countries, it's 70% of the labor force is in the informal sector. Let's make it in a way that's productive for women. I think the point about entrepreneurs is an important one. But there are ways we can actually even make some of these small enterprises, regulate them just to the point. Don't make them. You don't necessarily have to make them formal, but get them to the point where they are able to, where women are able to work in a safe environment.
All right, Magdi, you want to chime in?
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what's said. First of all, the entrepreneurial power of women in the region, for sure. I was a judge in the Injaz competition a few years ago, and I was just amazed by the women, the capability of women in the region, the teams coming from the Gulf and the Saudis. The winner was a Palestinian team led by a woman, but the second and third place finishers were also very female-oriented teams. I'm just amazed by it, and certainly there are sectors, the IT sector is very gender neutral. Social entrepreneurship seems to be quite popular among, at least when I was in Egypt, the lot of the most promising ventures were there. So I like entrepreneurship. I also think we do need to stop looking at the informal sector only as a problem to be somehow, you know, wished away, but really work with the bulk of the private sector there and see what we can do to make them more productive. I just want to say also there is a culture and family element. My mother and her sister were both the two people in the family of my grandmother. My mother, they both went, I'm Nubian, they went to Egypt and lived there. There was some problem back in the village, and my aunt had to be sent back to the village to take care of an older person. Where my mother stayed in Cairo, she became a medical doctor, and my aunt is illiterate. So the long-term consequences of these choices and the impact of family and society, it just played out like that. There's no judgment as to who's happier, who's had a more fulfilling life. But if we're talking about employment and ability to contribute, the signals sent and those choices, those chance opportunities that females experience, much more so than men, I think we need to take that quite seriously and think about what we can do to send the right signals.
All right. Hafiz, did you want to say something as well before we go to questions?
Yes, I'm dying to say something.
Good, excellent.
First of all, I don't think that the region, the Arab region in general, will have stable development, social and economic and political development, unless they resolve the issue of gender inequality. You cannot have a stable society with such huge inequalities, with half of society being sort of shut out of the market. And as I was saying before, the fact that you're teaching the girls and then they're not working is a waste, an economic waste. It's also, if you look at it from a family point perspective, you cannot develop a middle class with just one bread earner in the family. You need two people to be working, as we see all around the world, in order to develop a middle class. And we know that a middle class is essential for the economic development, for democratic development, and for social stability. So this is really an issue that has to be tackled, and it is not. I think what Lisbeth was talking about it on access to education. This part is very important. I feel that there has been progress on that side in terms of educating girls. However, we need to do something on access to labor markets, access to jobs. And that's where I feel that there is virtually no progress has been achieved. If anything, there has been a regression on that side, because in the past, women typically found jobs in government and in the public sectors, and now the governments and public sectors are not hiring. Right. So the women were the first people to suffer from that. But some of the issues that Perihan raised are things that need to be addressed. Can we invest in preschool or nurseries for children, so that the women can go to work? What kind of work environment can we have? Can we have special programs, special interventions for to develop women entrepreneurship, or to help women get their first jobs and so on? So there are many ideas and many things that need to be looked at and need to be analyzed.
So we've had a good roundup of all the different issues that are connected to education. Obviously, we are discussing the education sector in the Arab world, the missed opportunities perhaps for Arab youth, but it does connect to entrepreneurship, to the job market, to gender inequality in the region, and of course all of those potentially, when they are problematic, lead to political unrest as well, which is what we've seen unfold over the last few years in the region. I'm going to open the floor now to questions from the audience. If you raise your hand, wait for the mic to come to you and introduce yourself, please, and keep your questions brief so that we can have as many as possible. We have about half an hour. There's a question in the back. Gentleman with the glasses, thank you.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for
Could you
being
speak
here.
In the mic, please?
Yes. My name is Ethan Schiller. I'm from Department of State. And I have a specific question for Magdi Amin. How prevalent, or anybody else on the panel that can answer to it, how prevalent is vocational education in the region? And how vocational is it really? How hands-on training-oriented is it? Or is it just still rote classroom knowledge and not really effective skill building? And I, in particular, Mr. Amin, I'm interested in learning more about your Education for Employment initiative for Arab youth, so I'll come talk to you after. But in terms of vocational education, is it common in the region? And if it's not, how could it possibly help with that transition from higher education to the labor market and economic development? Thank you.
Go ahead. We'll...
So there is vocational, and there's a substantial amount of countries that are investing in vocational education. But it has this, the problems that we talked about. Morocco, for example, there is a levy on the private sector and other firms that then goes to finance the vocational training. But it is managed by the same institution that operates a large share of the vocational centers. So there's a sort of inherent conflict of interest that's crowding out this kind of competition entry of the private sector that we'd like to see. A lot of the people that exit the vocational system aren't meeting the needs of the private sector. There's not enough sort of practical internship type elements, the sort of the German system that we know here as well. And we have also good experiences on the other side. Morocco has attracted, for example, some aeronautics firms and some rail firms as well. They have invested in some of the vocational system to produce the supply chain of skills that they need. Those are working extremely well. So the counterexample to the inflexible system that many students go into because they fail to meet the qualifications of the main education system, so it's seen as a choice not valued enough by society. It's not seen as a very productive choice to be making. So the system really, it's there, but a lot of the reforms that we've been sort of talking about here really do need to be focused heavily on the vocational system.
Thank you, Magdi. More questions? Let's have someone here in the front, please.
Hi, my name is Meher Kayum. I'm a political economy blogger. My question is actually for Perihan. You brought up a really good point about how media can influence or impact women, like the CSI program. Just wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more. I know your background is in media in Egypt, but can you maybe share an example that can go beyond Egypt as well, since it has a lot of women in STEM?
And how that also can be used in the educational system to reinforce positive messaging?
I'll share an example, a couple of examples, but in the specific education part, there's a huge wave of crowdsourcing educational content, and the great thing about it is that there's two nonprofit organizations that are doing this now in Egypt. One is called Tahrir Academy and one is called Nafham, and the cool thing about it is that it's the majority of the people that are creating those videos are women. And obviously their parents trying to teach their kids and create videos that will actually help other people as well. But it's great because you see there in that video that it's homemade, you see a woman, a mother who looks exactly like, you know, every other woman on the street that's teaching physics and teaching math. So it's not only, you know, it's science in that video is gender neutral. But on the bigger scale, basically, of productions, in movies and in series, we need to present women in scripts. And that is something that could be, you know, working basically done through working closely with the studios or with the formal entertainment industry on how you can actually present women in different roles in society in your movies. Women should no longer just be, you know, those cute, you know, representing those like cute romantic, you know, characters. There should be more. You should show women that are successful, and also even not show women that are successful to be extremely, you know, masculine. We wanna present in the media people that look exactly like us, and that is something that changed in the U.S. because there is that engagement with you know, through social TV and through social networks in general. There is engagement with what the studios are producing, and it's still growing in our region. But I think when you have that, then they're forced to basically create characters that reflect the mainstream representation of women, basically.
One more question. In the middle, with the white shirt.
Hello, my name is Uzma Anzar, and I work for a university research center.
Could you get the microphone a bit closer?
Yes. I was wondering if the panelists have anything to say about the effectiveness of international aid agencies in the Arab world. I was talking to the Minister of Education from Yemen recently, and he had an earful about some agencies who are working in Yemen and have failed to deliver. So I was wondering, what are your thoughts on that?
Shanta, perhaps you want to take that question?
I think I know which agency he was referring to. No, this is a really important issue because
and it ties into what you were saying about benchmarks. How many kids are enrolled versus what is the quality?
And it is because the international aid agencies have been supporting education in these countries, particularly the poorer ones, for a long time. For a long time, we were building schools, but then we built lots of schools where there were no teachers. And then we've moved on a little bit on to supporting education reform in some of these countries, teacher training, and all of these. But I think there's still a fundamental problem, which is the failure, as I was saying earlier, is a failure of accountability between the citizens of these countries, the parents and the teachers, and the public sector. But our aid is going to that public sector. Indeed, even more so, our policy advice is going to that public sector. So you can see the tension here. And I think, I mean, there's no easy answer to this, but I think one thing which we've been championing quite a bit, actually when Tamar was in the bank as well, is to at least evaluate our interventions. Get the information out there that if you spend $500 million on an education project and student learning outcomes don't improve, you've got a problem. And that's as much of a lesson for us to change things as it is for the government, so we can actually hold ourselves accountable. And that's where we're making some progress, but there's a long way to go.
Thank you, Shanta. Question all the way in the back, the man with the hat, please. Oh, two men with hats. Well, we'll do both.
Yeah, to be polite. Thank you very much. That's a wonderful discussion. My name is James. I'm a research fellow with a not-profit organization. So my question is, if you look at educational issues from a global perspective, and there are many factors that we should consider, and I appreciate you're talking in a very broad spectrum, but I was wondering if there's a deeper factors in which affect you know, the educational opportunities for the girls and the youth in the Arab world. And if you look at this country, and we emphasize equality for everybody, and the Amish people, and they are very different from the rest of us. And if you look at Japan, and the Japanese women, and the majority of them prefer to stay home, even though they may have a PhD, well educated. So that's a culture and tradition. And for many people back in before World War II and in Europe, and the women prefer to stay home. And in this country as well, And just a few days ago, then and some leader in on the Capitol Hill, they emphasized, hey, that with Obamacare and the women, they don't have to stay on the job and to maintain their health insurance for the family, and because they prefer perhaps to stay with home with the family and taking care of the children. And I was wondering, and if there's a deeper something that culture or religions factors that affect the current situation in the Arab world for the women education and the what you mentioned, the missed opportunity for the youth. Thank you very
much. Thank you. I mean, obviously, gender inequality is not fully the focus of this discussion, but it is part of the issue that we are seeing with education. Hafiz, perhaps you want to address this briefly. I mean, obviously, gender inequality is an issue everywhere, including still in the U.S. as well. There are many people who complain about how few women star in roles in Hollywood films, so it's not just an issue that we see in the Arab world. But tell us a little bit more, Hafiz.
No, obviously, there is a cultural aspect. I mean, you are right. I mean, the Arab societies are very conservative societies, and as Perihan was explaining, there is this stereotype of the woman staying at home, looking after her children, and so on and so forth. So obviously, there is a cultural aspect. However, that does not mean that you have to accept it or you have to believe that this is the right thing. Cultures do evolve. Cultures do change. We have seen the cultures change around us. We have seen even Arab cultures changing over the years. What I have been saying is that there is a need to change the views on gender and to move towards a much more gender-neutral society, much more gender equality, and that this is necessary for economic reasons as well as for social reasons. So while I agree that this is cultural, I don't think that this means that we should just accept it and do nothing about it.
Thank you. Gentleman with the hat in the last row, please.
My name is Hector Santos. I work for the National University of Honduras.
Could you bring the microphone a bit closer, please?
My name is Hector Santos. I work for the National University of Honduras, which is a public university that has more women enrolled than men by now, which is a very good thing. My question is about the role of private education. In the case that I have seen around the world, you used to have traditional private schools of very, very good quality. Very small elite went to those ones. With time, there was a proliferation of less credible private schools where the people who couldn't get to the very top ones send their kids there. A lot of those experiments were terrible. They were selling diplomas. At higher education, too, we had experience, Dominican Republic, selling medical school diplomas to American students. My question is about this. Removing the group that has more political power, more economic power, from pressure to change public schooling. And you leave the people who are with less political power, less economic power, going to the largest part of the educational system, which is the public school, which is the pressure now to change that part.
Magdi, and perhaps Shanta as well, I think you both have something to say about this.
Okay, I think your name was Hector. Thank you for the question. Look, you're absolutely right. It is not only about entry of the private sector in an unconstrained way where quality doesn't matter. What we're saying is that the status quo, which is predominantly public sector, the enrollment rates, the enrollment ratios between public and private sector are disproportionate, something like 12% private on average. I may not have this statistic right, but it's close to that number, well above 80% across the region in the public sector. The public sector-driven system has failed the region's youth. Okay, that's the point of departure here. And what we're saying is that the system is not responsive and not focused enough on quality, whether we're talking public or private delivery. So the solution would be to be more responsive, to be transparent, to have things like the barometer out there that is making it clear to everybody what the outcomes are, to allow innovation in delivery, and so that the system is flexible and responsive, and that is regulated, and that account the accreditation of universities, whether they be public or private, that they're held to a high standard and a relevant standard. So that's the argument here, not to simply move everything to the private sector and or allow unconstrained entry into the private sector. Just to be clear there.
Chantal, you want to chime in?
Yeah, just 2 points to what Magdi just said. I mean, first of all, let's keep in mind that the rationale for having free public universities, for instance, is to enable poor people to have a chance of getting a university education. So that was the objective, and it clearly failed because, as you said, most of the people who go to those free public universities are the elites because they're the ones who can afford to send their kids to distinguished secondary schools in order to compete for the exams to get into the primary school. So you've got a serious problem here where the actual stated objective is not being met. Now, I think the point about allowing private schools is really the competition. It's really being able to bring in some contestability to that public school system. And it's very interesting. I mean, you find that when you try to introduce the bill to allow for private universities, the biggest resistance comes from the public university, you know, which are completely full. They have lots of students and everything else. But there's and even the regulation, and I fully agree, you've got to regulate that private sector, just like in almost all other cases as well. And it's very interesting. And one other country, not in the Arab region, they were introduced private schools, and so we had this regulatory system to regulate quality, actually, to check. And so, you know, I naively suggested, I said, well, while you're doing it, why don't you check on the quality of the public school system, too? Oh, no, God forbid. You know, we can't even subject ourselves to regulations. It gives you an idea of the kind of resistance you're facing.
Thank you both. Question in the front. Gentleman with the red tie, please.
Yes. I was wondering if you could comment on... Thank you. I was wondering if you could comment on how effective you think a program like Teach for America would be in the Middle East and North Africa.
Teach for America.
Like a Middle Eastern version.
I think it's a great idea. Clearly, we have a lot of well-trained youth. And by and large, you know, what...